You're listening to The Pulse on University Radio Nottingham.
It's been a year since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the biggest war on European soil since World War II. Within a few weeks of the invasion beginning, Russian troops were in control of large areas of Ukraine. They had advanced to the suburbs of Kiev and controlled much of the northeast of the country around Sumy. They were bombarding Kharkiv and they had taken territory in the east and south as far as Kherson, surrounding the port city of Mariupol. Am I saying
Mariupol?
Mariupol, yeah. Yep. Let's go with that. By October, the picture had changed dramatically. Having failed to take Kiev, Russia withdrew from the north, and Ukraine had its first major success, pushing Russia back from Kharkiv and counterattacking around Kherson. 1 year since the invasion, Ukraine is in control of Kherson, and fighting is concentrated in the east, with the heaviest around the town of Bakhmut.
Just to touch on the media coverage, I remember towards the start of this, you know, there was a lot of sort of domestic, politicky, newsy stuff going on. And I remember at the time, a lot of people were concerned that, you know, this was going to be sort of brushed to the wayside. It's going to be a story for a little bit longer than most other stories, but it's going to be. But I'm very glad that it's been such a sort of, the media coverage of it has been so good that, you know, we're still here talking about it a year later. We're still here, you know, seeing very accurate, very up-to-date, positive news as well about the counter-offensives, about how Ukraine is receiving supplies from other European nations. You know, it's still at the forefront of the media coverage, and I think that is a good thing. Obviously, ideally, you know, no media coverage due to no more conflict would be ideal, but I think the media coverage being still as strong as it is a very good thing.
I think it's important that it hasn't been brushed under the rug. Would you agree, Kit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think because I remember when this was sort of brewing over a year ago now, back in kind of January, the early February 2022, it was the media coverage was very much, oh, what's Russia doing? You know, why are they all lining up? And then it became kind of, oh, they're probably going to launch an invasion. But I think the media coverage before they did invade was more sort of like, oh, it's going to happen, it's going to be bad, Russia's just going to storm in, take over, and that will be that. And then when it did happen and it became apparent that Ukraine was actually, not to be a flippant, but putting up more of a fight than expected, I think, like you say, Connor, it was nice to see that attitude kind of be more reflected and the tone kind of pivot to a much more positive, I mean, it's not positive, obviously, it's a war, it's very horrible, but a much more kind of hopeful outlook in terms of the potential outcome for Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, because it is the biggest conflict, it's also the biggest wartime refugee crisis since the Second World War as well. Mm. It's done a lot of damage to the nation, and I think Zelensky said that if all the allies go through on their promises, then the end is nearing.
Connor, you raise a really, really important point about the refugee crisis that it's prompted. You know, there are millions and millions of people displaced. Crisis has inflated kind of European refugee and migration numbers by, it's something like 50% or something ridiculous. Like, it's a really, really huge movement of people. And so there's a massive humanitarian crisis happening kind of in tandem with the war itself, and that will take maybe not as much effort and resources, but certainly, you know, a huge amount of that to combat it, as well as combating Russian forces.
Although the Ukraine versus Russia war is obviously located between Ukraine and Russia, we are seeing the consequences worldwide. There's refugees, as you've just discussed, Kit, having to travel across the world just to find somewhere safe to live, just to be able to get some form of normality. And again, I think that's something that particularly today a lot of people are reflecting on, and it's what more could other countries be doing to help bring this war to an end, to help refugees, to help those in Ukraine who are suffering, and kind of just ensure it comes to peaceful terms. As there was a UN meeting last night where they were trying to discuss having a peace protocol put in place, and they want countries like China to agree to it, pretty much. Mm. And it's very interesting that it has taken a year for other countries to now start kind of taking more formidable steps. Mm. And I use formidable not in terms of getting directly involved in the war, but more in terms of actually addressing it and realizing that this is not something that they can just stand by and watch.
Fairly early on, if we sort of think back, yeah, way back to kind of, well, a year ago now, February, March, the UK government was quite quick to set up their, I think they called it the Homes for Ukraine scheme, which was a sort of scheme where British people could sponsor Ukrainian refugees, either one or potentially a family, to come and live in their homes. And I think the scheme has... It's had its ups and downs over the year that it's been happening. Some have worked out really well. I know in my local community where I come from, in East Devon, and also where I live here in Beeston, there have been, you know, lots and lots of success stories about Ukrainian refugees being housed in British homes and being found jobs and things like that. But there have also been bumps in the road. The scheme had flaws when it began because of the way it was designed. It did sort of allow people with more unsavoury intentions to house refugees, perhaps the background checks, the sort of criteria for who could host weren't quite as well thought out, and the people weren't necessarily kept tabs on perhaps as much as they should have been. And obviously part of that is because it was a scheme that was thought up so quickly.
I mean, I think you know, as you mentioned, there is a stark difference between how the government has reacted in this instance versus how it has reacted to refugees coming from, you know, other war-torn areas. You know, the scheme, as you said, was quite quick to come up with it, which has led to some holes, but it was very quick. People have been much more receptive to it. People have, you know, like in a broader scale, like there's not been nearly as many sort of public, like, migrants, refugees, that there tends to be when, you know, people talk about migrants and refugees, you know, in this instance compared to others. And because, you know, the UK government isn't trying to send, you know, Ukrainian citizens to another country. I think that it's a shame that the cracks are in the scheme. But I think I remember last October there were a couple of issues, because I believe a lot of the scheme was immediately very much so a short-term thing, and then there wasn't as much support, especially for refugees who don't necessarily speak English well enough, who don't have the same sort of understanding of how to find a place to live, how to jobs, visas, things like that. All of this going on whilst family members are, you know, fighting in the conflict, or family members are suffering from a bereavement. You know, this is a incredibly harrowing time for these families coming over to a new country, and the initial support was there, but I feel like the long-term support, I think, also wasn't very well thought out, and I think that could also be something that the government needs to continue reviewing, because as we're a year in, you know, whilst gains have been made, as we mentioned, by Ukraine, you know, Russia certainly isn't gone, and I think, you know, by this point, the UK government should be looking at much more long-term solutions.
Yeah, definitely. I think those are some really good points. And I also think we have to sort of compare to what the government's other refugee schemes have been so far to sort of look at the impact. And I say compared to what is sort of generally a very, well, much criticised set of policies, this has been sort of relative to that quite successful. In that, I think we're on over 160,000 Ukrainians have made it to the UK so far, which is a lot more than any other individual scheme has processed in that time frame. And, you know, this is contrast this with all the backlogs in other areas of the Home Office. So in that sense, this has been quite an effective rollout. So I think obviously on that scale, you're going to have some people that, you know, have a worse experience than others, but looking at it from this perspective, from a government that is struggling, to put it lightly, with the refugee handling at the moment, I think it's been one of the more impressive areas.
With today being the 1 year anniversary of the start of the invasion, Zelensky has been asked a bunch of questions about his thoughts. Particularly, one Ukrainian journalist asked him to recall the most horrible day or night in the war, and who has disappointed him in the last 12 months. Zelensky started by saying everyone who left Ukraine on the 24th of February instead of fighting for the country disappointed him. And then thinking about what he views as his most horrible moment, he mentions the Bucha massacre, which was a massacre in April in a town just outside of Kiev, which had been under Russian control before Ukrainian forces fought back and discovered mass graves and a town destroyed. He says, what I saw, it was horrible. What we have seen, the devil is not somewhere in the bottom, but it is on us. For context, the massacre, when people arrived, the streets were strewn with at least 20 bodies after Russian forces made a rapid retreat from around Kiev, which was initially seen as, you know, one of the big positive pushes because Kiev is the capital of Ukraine. But it's certainly, you know, a showing that bombardment, because all 20 of the dead had been shot in the back of the head, with other bodies lying in wrecks of cars destroyed by shelling, with 280 people buried in mass graves. And obviously this is quite a, I can't find the word for it to describe
horrifying.
This topic. Horrifying, yeah, topic, you know, that this sort of thing can happen in a conflict that people should be, a nation should have the values of, this is something acceptable, because it's utterly not acceptable in any way, shape or form, especially as these people were, you know, civilians. They were not necessarily fighting. These were people killed indiscriminately by shelling, and also people killed directly by Russian soldiers taking matters into their own hands, as sort of a very what seems to be on the retreat from the area. You know, it seems very cruel, unnecessarily cruel. And I, what do you guys think about this?
I mean, I think it's telling that you couldn't find a word to describe what it's like. I mean, I really do think there aren't words to describe the extent of the cruelty, the deliberate cruelty of what, you know, some of the Russian forces have been doing in Ukraine to civilians. I think it kind of puts paid to this idea. Obviously, you know, it's what Russia is doing. It's, they've got imperialist objectives. You know, that's essentially what is happening. You know, they do want to take it back. They want to expand. But I think it puts paid to any kind of Russian, I don't even want to say propaganda, but Russian kind of statements that suggest they're doing this with sort of a higher purpose, that suggests they have some kind of right to Ukraine, that suggests they're doing this and they're justified in their actions because the way they are behaving is just so cruel and unnecessary. And I think it's clear that, you know, not only were they not prepared to face the resistance from Ukraine that they have, but also that they cannot cope with that kind of resistance, and they are not behaving in the way that armed forces should, and that they obviously do see Ukrainian citizens as beneath them. I think it's abundantly clear.
I think that's a really relevant point there, Kit, and I think it ties into, you know, what we've been seeing a lot from Zelensky in particular, in that they are in Ukraine viewing this as sort of a war against, like, or for the eradication of the Ukrainian identity itself. Like, I think it has been quite overt in Russian propaganda that this is about basically erasing the existence of these people by sort of enforcing a Russian identity on this entire region. So I think when you put it in that context, like, you have some people in the West advocating that, you know, aspects of this should be called a genocide, because if not always a physical one, then a cultural one, because I think that is a big motive for this war. It's not just about, you know, it's not just a land grab. It's more than that. It's like a war of a nation that is trying to aggrandize itself and its own identity, like the Russian people. That's sort of what Putin's already, like, always been talking about. And it reminds me of something I heard, like, a few weeks ago. I saw this propaganda poster that was in one of the occupied cities in Ukraine. And basically there's a common theme. They always show these, you know, these historical Russian figures that maybe 100, 200 years ago had lived there, sort of erasing any Ukrainian presence from this area. So I think if we're talking about these massacres, I think is it inevitable when you're waging a war with this sort of objective that fundamentally sees Ukraine as inferior or even non-existent?
I think it's also just extremely dehumanizing just hearing everything that's going on there, just knowing all of this is happening to innocent people, to a lot of families, a lot of children are involved in this as well. And it's quite harrowing to see this happen in this day and age after we've already had two world wars, after there's been so many wars across the country over the past few decades, and the fact that we can still have something like this happen. People are still so occupied with their need for greed, pretty much, to have power, to have control over people. And it's quite scary just to think that had a lot of us here in the UK been in Ukraine instead, that could be us in the midst of it all. And I think one of the main things we have to remember with kind of reading all of the articles about the war going on in Ukraine, about keeping up with everything going on and showing our support, is that we are from an outside perspective. We don't know what is truly going on there. We also need to remember to be kind to any refugees, particularly here, just as we were speaking previously about, because we don't know what they've gone through. We don't know the exact incidents or violence they have experienced. With the massacre, there was 20 bodies found in this town, and they are people's family, they're people's friends, they're people's loved ones. Thank you to our listeners today for tuning in. We hope that you have found this special very informative, and that you may go on to address some of the things that we have spoken about, whether that be supporting refugees, whether that's attending the vigils and the marches, or just keeping in tune with all of the news about the Ukraine versus Russia war.
You're listening to The Pulse on University Radio Nottingham.